The Dr. Molly Barrow Show, Tuesdays at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Dr. Molly Barrow Show. I'm the author of Matchlines for Singles and the Malia and Teacup Self-Esteem-Building Adventure Series for Children. Do you ever wonder why some people have successful lives? Well, we are here to explore psychological and practical problem solving, from personal issues to world events. Hey, please join the conversation by calling 1-888-874-4888. We have an outstanding guest today. We have Lauren Mackler. Lauren is a world-renowned coach, founder of the Illuminaire Coach Institute, and author of the international bestseller Soulmate, and that's S-O-L-E-M-A-T-E, Master the Art of Aloneness and Transform Your Life. She's a leading expert in human behavior, relationships, work, and leadership. Lauren has helped people around the world create the personal and professional lives to which they aspire. Welcome, Lauren, to the Dr. Molly Barrow Show.
Really great to be with you, Molly.
Good to be here with you. So you're a blogger for Huffington Post. You're on CNN, Fox. I mean, you're all over the place, Wall Street Journal. What is it that you're trying to teach people?
Well, if I were to bottom line it to kind of one line, I guess I would say really what all my work is about is it's about helping people become the person they were born to be. And when we're born, we are, you know, we're born whole. We're very integrated human beings, and we're born with innate personality traits and talents and strengths and gifts, and the ability to feel, you know, the wide range of human emotion. And we're born with a very intact self-esteem. And then we come into this wonderful thing called a family. And the life conditioning process then begins. And depending what's going on in our life, you know, in those early years where that shaping is the most intense, determines how much of that innate wholeness is allowed to remain and how much becomes eroded, gets kind of chipped away or goes underground. And so by the time most people become adults, they've lost parts of their innate wholeness because most people grew up in families that have at least some level of dysfunction. So the work that I do is about helping people understand what are the factors that have kept put a lid on their potential, what parts of their innate wholeness has been damaged or diminished or disenfranchised, and then doing the work that they need to do to reclaim those lost parts and bring that wholeness back into, you know, into being. And that's what my book Soulmate is all about. It's not about being alone. It's about relationship with yourself and becoming whole.
I really like that because I think so many people, certainly in my practice, have been terrorized. You know, they're just so afraid of being alone that they always gather people around them, even if they don't even like them.
That's so true. But, you know, we're conditioned, Molly, and I know you know this, it's preaching to the choir here. You know, we're so conditioned from early childhood on that, you know, focus on relationships with other people, and parents are setting up the play dates and they get anxious if their kids don't have enough friends, and, you know, we want to be part of the popular group, and then later on we want to have a boyfriend or a girlfriend and then a, you know, spouse. And there's all this focus on relationships with other people and not a lot of focus on relationship with oneself. And that's not part of the conditioning for most people. And yet I say to people, who's the one person that you're with 24/7 from the time you're born until you leave this earth? And that relationship should be the primary one because it's the one you're stuck with all the time. So it's counterintuitive not to pay attention to it.
You know, we have this dialogue that's going on in our heads all the time, and so often we're repeating just awful stuff that is left over from mean kids or mean teachers, you know, and it's just demoralizing to listen to yourself sometimes. How do you deal with that tape that's running in your head?
Well, there's what I call the conditioned self. So the conditioned self is who we become after life, you know, kind of has its way with us. And there's a few little components of the conditioned self, one of which is the core or the predominant role that we adopted in our family and played out in our family, and then that kind of continues, you know, as a habit throughout our lives. There's the core beliefs that you were just, you know, talking about, those messages, that tape. I call them core limiting beliefs, the ones that are dragging us down. And then the third component are the habitual behavioral patterns that we adopt as part of our role that are driven by those core beliefs. And the tough thing is that a lot of people aren't really clear about what aspects of their conditioned self are running them, because those patterns are embedded in the subconscious, so it's kind of hard to get to them. But, you know, those patterns may have made a lot of sense growing up because they allowed us to, you know, adapt to and function within our family. But unless we update our conditioned self and, you know, retrieve the authentic self and update our default operating system, how we think and behave on autopilot, we're at the mercy of those, you know, what you call the tapes running, you know, over and over again and doing sort of self-torture. It's really, really awful. Maybe habit and familiar, but it's very, very distressing to live under that kind of constant, you know, whether it's demeaning, whether it's putting pressure on us, whatever those tapes are doing, because they'll be different for different people. But they really, those are some of the things that keep a lid on our potential.
You know, what I like about this is that it's pretty unique. I mean, I don't think a lot of people have really taught this. I mean, there's a lot of work on relationships. There's a lot of work on being a better person. But I'm not so sure there's a lot of work on going back to that childlike person that's wonderful to begin with.
Yeah, I think that, you know, there's certainly some practitioners that are family systems oriented, family systems trained, but I'm actually just sort of amazed that that component is so absent from psychotherapy. I won't say coaching, because the majority of coaches don't have, you know, the psychology background, but those that do, even those, they're not really addressing, you know, maybe a little bit, kind of, you know, visiting a little bit, trying to help, you know, them understand where they come from. But in my experience, the family of origin is where everything is rooted. Where, I mean, because the most intense formation is happening in the first 7 years. The brain is even functioning at a different frequency in those first 7 years. It's all about gathering information and trying to figure out, you know, make sense out of this world and how to function and adapt to and survive within it. And so, to me, it makes so much sense to spend time not to, you know, put a client through the wrenching emotions that may have been going on back then, or traumas and that kind of thing, but simply from an understanding of what was going on, what kind of system. And I do this work with every client with whom I work and in many of my workshops, and I actually take the reader through this process in the book of identifying what kind of family system did they grow up in. You know, was it a healthy constructive system, which is almost none, or, you know, was it a dysfunctional system? To what degree was it dysfunctional? What kind of dysfunction was going on? And what were the core messages? What were those core beliefs that I internalized? And they're not conscious thoughts. They're like habitual perceptions. It's how we see the world. It's how we see ourselves. They're conclusions or truths that we adapt or adopt. And what were the behavioral patterns that we adopted and habituated to kind of function and interface with the world? And those things are rooted in the family of origin, and it's a critical piece of the work. And I think that, but then if you just do that, you know, if you're just staying there and you're not now applying the coaching piece, because in my work, I've developed this method called Illumineering Coaching, and it combines family systems work, psychodynamic psychology, which is the psychology that involves the subconscious, and action-oriented coaching. So I've tried to kind of get the best of both worlds. So you've got the understanding and the awareness of how you operate and where it comes from, but then implementing very action-oriented strategies and new things, the steps that you're going to take, that's going to create a new experience and over time a new internal reference point that will override the old default operating system and allow you to think and behave in alignment with the kind of life that you want to be living and the results that you want to produce.
All right, we're talking to Lauren Mackler, who's the international bestseller author of Soulmate and Master the Art of Aloneness and Transform Your Life. Now, if somebody has the courage to go back and look at their family of origin, even if it's, you know, pretty scary, part of what you do is not to leave them there, but to actually coach them back to a different place. What is your, you know, where do you want to get them to?
Well, I'll give you a concrete example. And by the way, that family of origin analysis work, we do that in one session, just so you know. You know, that piece of work is I mean, they have assignments, they have homework that they do in preparation for our coaching review session. But I'll give you an example. So let's say, for example, this is a real client, a coaching client that I'm working with right now. And this is a guy whose pattern, his primary role in his family was the hero. He was the high-achieving son, straight A's, captain of the football team, head of the debate club. You know, it was all about achievement, and that was reinforced in his family. He was kind of the golden boy, wunderkind, you know, immigrant background family, you know, and he had all the shining hopes, you know, for this family. And he became very, very successful as an entrepreneur in his 30s. And he came to me because he was very depressed. He didn't know why. He just wasn't really finding any pleasure in his life. And he wasn't sure, maybe he needed to make a professional change. Maybe the company he'd founded wasn't really what he wanted to be doing. And we did this process. And what we identified is that, you know, and as part of my illumineering process, we also very specifically identify what are the parts that got lost, what parts of our wholeness, you know, of the client's wholeness were compromised or damaged or had to kind of be, you know, diminished. And then, okay, so now we've got all this information. Now we get into the action piece. So one of the things that we identified as a lost part was his ability to be spontaneous and playful. He's a very, very serious guy, perfectionist, high achiever, everything has to be perfect, always censoring everything he did. So what I asked him to do is go and sign up for and do an improvisational comedy workshop. Because by doing that, he has no time to think. And it's connecting him to that spontaneous, playful part because it's fun and gives him a new reference point, a new experience. Because if I just talk about being spontaneous or playful, that part was shut down so long ago, he doesn't even know what I'm talking about. Intellectually he does, but not experientially. And so he did that, and that kind of reawakened and reconnected him to that part. And, you know, other kinds of things. I've had him go to amusement parks with his children and go on the rides. So things like that, and that's just one little tiny example. But that's what I mean by taking the information and the assessment work and learning and the awareness and now doing something that is going to give you a whole new experience. And you do those new things enough times to where that internal new reference point becomes solidified and it overrides the old memories and associations that you have from the past. And that's how transformation happens.
So you can change those definitions that other people gave you as you were a little child and growing up. You can change those by taking an active action, like taking action and reopening these closed places, these places that shut down. That
That's right.
You're not the kind of kid that gets to be happy. You're not the kind of kid that gets to be spontaneous.
Exactly.
What are some of these other, we're talking to Lauren Mackler, and this is fantastic stuff. What are some of these other parts that could be diminished that you found in your practice?
So a common one, especially for women, more for women than men, but men have it too, is the ability to feel and express anger. So let's say you grew up in a family where, let's say dad had a tendency to drink a little bit too much. And when he drank, maybe he got kind of volatile, kind of scary, yelling. You know, you kind of learn to walk on eggshells. And so, and never express anger. And in fact, you have such an aversion to angry expression that you get very nervous around it. And maybe your way of managing that is learning to walk on eggshells and try to figure out what people want and are expect of you and try to meet those needs and making other people's needs more important than your own and never saying what you need, never saying how you feel. And just never being able to be angry. You know, you tend to internalize that anger and turns into more depression than outward anger. So now you're going through your adult life and you don't feel or express anger because that part has been so underdeveloped, it's been so held captive, it's been buried so far, you know, inside that you don't even know how to do that. And that means then, you know, the cost of that is internalized anger, which turns into depression, is a form of chronic stress. When you're under chronic stress and it happens long enough, it can actually make you ill because the stress hormones compromise your immune system, weaken the immune system. So you could be setting up the scenario where, let's say, there's other kinds of factors like maybe, you know, environmental exposure to something or, you know, there's a genetic predisposition towards a certain illness, you know, that you have. And that chronic stress can be the tipping point that allows a life-threatening illness to take hold or like lupus or cancer or something like that. So it can actually affect your physical health. And then,
and that should make you really angry.
Pardon me?
And that should make you really angry.
Well, yeah, but see, these people don't do anger.
Right.
You know, and then also, anger is a normal emotion, and it's a way of setting a boundary with someone saying, hey, that's not okay for me. Stop it. That's okay, you know. But people that have that particular pattern, they can't do that. So they end up being taken for granted, treated like a doormat, which, of course, you know, keeps feeding into their depression and their feeling of being unvalued, unappreciated, and internal resentment, you know, which is pretty toxic. So that's another example. Another example could be someone's, you know, sexuality and sensuality. They were shamed, you know, so they always hide their body, you know, in baggy clothes, and they can't, you know, they always feel like they're, you know, doing something wrong if they have sex because it was so conditioned that it was, you know, wrong and sinful or, you know, all those kinds of things.
How did you find this in yourself to start talking about the art of aloneness? I mean, where did that come from in you?
Well, it came from my own personal experience, and I had gotten married at 23. I married my knight in shining armor. He was a doctor from Europe, and I moved to his country. And I worked in his medical practice as a therapist, and I built my whole life based on who he was and him. And I was, even though I worked in his practice, you know, I didn't see any of the money, and I was, he handled all the finances. I was financially dependent in that way. And when my marriage ended in my late 30s, life as I knew it fell apart completely. And we had a very painful divorce, and I couldn't survive we were living in Germany, and I was sort of, in a way, I won't say forced out because that's kind of the victim, but I was in a finance, I had set it up, you know, we definitely colluded that, you know, in terms of how we set up our lives, where I had no money. And so I took my two kids and I came back to the U.S. and moved in with my parents, because I had not a penny to my name. After, you know, 2 years of going through a divorce and trying to stay in Germany and trying to survive, I was very, very depressed by the time I came back to this country. In fact, I was suicidal, but that was not an option. I would never do that to my children. It was also against my belief system. And I found myself living back in the small town, feeling completely shattered. And I couldn't find any useful support where I was living. And so I went back to school to get my American degrees because I had been trained in Europe. And I put together this thing called a self-renewal program. And I actually did it as a school project, and because I started doing this with myself, and I thought I'm going to use this as a model to work on creating, and I'm going to do this with myself. And I started doing certain things every single day to reframe what was going on with me and turn it into an opportunity. So there were certain things I did. Like every single day, I spent some time sitting there for 5 minutes and visualizing my ex-husband and myself being able to talk about everything that happened and move into forgiveness, because I was the anger and resentment was just toxic inside of me. That was something I needed to get rid of. I walked in this beautiful area for 5 miles every day. And I just focused on the beauty, and I focused, and I said things to myself out loud while I was walking that were sort of self-supporting. I started exercising every day. I wrote down, I made a list of all the challenges in my situation, and next to it, where are the opportunities, and then created strategies of how I was going to make them into opportunities. Did all these different things. Well, 2 years after the fact, I realized that I had created something that could be of value to other people. And I started teaching it, and I called it Mastering the Art of Aloneness. And I taught it, eventually it turned into a weekend workshop. And then about 10 years later, someone said, you really need to turn this into a book. And that's how Soulmate, which is S-O-L-E-M-A-T-E, a little play on words, that's how the Soulmate book came to be. But it was from my own experience.
Now, when you talk about, if there's somebody that's listening that really has some heartache, you say that you reframed some of the pain and anger that you were feeling. And one of the steps.
And the challenges.
One of the steps you took was to write down on a piece of paper the positive things that are going on in your life, or did you take the negative things? What was the first step to reframing? Like, how would someone start to do that?
Okay, so that's actually a real exercise in Soulmate. At the end of every chapter, the reader does the exercise. They do the work that I've been writing about. And this is actually one of the exercises called Challenges and Opportunities Exercise. And what you do is you make a list of everything that is hard right now, everything that is a source of struggle, source of unhappiness, source of fear, source of limitation. You make a list. So going back to my situation, some of the things on my list were I was a single parent. Their father was 4,000 miles away and not providing any support or any involvement, financial or otherwise. Another challenge I had was I had very, very little money. I hardly had any money to survive. And, things like that. So then next to each challenge, where's the opportunity? Where's the opportunity? So next to where I wrote down their father's 4,000 miles away, the opportunity was I can raise them as I see fit. I don't have the conflict of them having to go to another house every week with a different set of rules and feeling kind of in the middle. They don't have to have the back and forth, which is hard for kids, that have to shuffle back and forth to two houses. I saw that as an opportunity. Not having any money or very little money. The opportunity was I had never known how to manage money. And so what I did is I created a monthly budget. And I went to the bank and I got a whole bunch of envelopes and I labeled each envelope. And every month I would go and get my cash for that month, which was very limited, and I would divvy it up into these envelopes, and I became this really disciplined money manager. So things like that. I was terrified to be alone. And the opportunity was learning how to feel comfortable and confident in my ability to take care of myself and my children and be content and happy on my own, because I always, felt I couldn't do that unless I was in a relationship. So those are just some examples. And by doing that and identifying the opportunities, and then the third piece is you got to create an action plan of, the opportunity, learn how to manage money. What's the action plan? Create a budget, create a strategy, go to the bank, do this. You got to have the strategy, which is important. And now you're focusing on, new opportunities, and you're bringing them to fruition. And it automatically reframes it from something horrible to something that you can actually, see as a positive opportunity for yourself.
When I work with kids, I am so touched by their hope. They have just this boundless hope.
That's right, yeah.
And when I work with adults, they have such you know, despair. And that hope is just gone somewhere. And I think I somehow managed to stay childlike because I wake up in the morning and I have all this hope for the day. And I think that's a huge thing that what you just described can give you hope, even
oh,
if you're
yes.
completely underwater.
Oh, yes. And I've been to that other place, believe me. I mean, I've been to that place of hopelessness. And it's very, very debilitating. It's very debilitating. And so when you can look at something from a new perspective and start to see the opportunity, and then you actually start to bring those opportunities into, you know, fruition, that then gives you the impetus to kind of keep going, and you see, and it empowers you, you know, kind of see, okay, I can do this, you know, this can work, you know? And I think that it's a really powerful exercise. And it takes you out of feeling like a victim to feeling, you know, taking responsibility for your life, for one thing. And then, you know, as you start to take that responsibility and you start to see that, hey, I am a powerful being. I can do this. I'm going to make it. It's a wonderful thing.
We're talking to Lauren Mackler, and she is the author of Soul Mate, Master the Art of Aloneness and Transform Your Life. We have just a few minutes before the break, Lauren, but, you know, I wanted to talk a little bit about where you think marriage is going in relationships. I mean, you're talking about the alone. Do you see us as becoming a lonelier society?
Well, we definitely have had a shift happen, and this is a shift that's been, you know, happening over the last 40 years, and nearly half of all American adults are actually living single lives, believe it or not. Because when people are single and they're walking around longing for Prince or Princess Charming, all they see are couples, you know, because they're looking at it through that lens. But the truth is that more and more people are living single lives. Women and men are marrying later. Some are not marrying at all. And, you know, and there's a lot of reasons why that shift has happened. It seems like we're moving more towards serial monogamy than, you know, till death do us part. And I'm not advocating for either one. It just seems to be what's happening. So we do need some new, you know, tools for how to be on our own. And yet most people that are on their own are in kind of a waiting mode, waiting for that person to show up to start their life, you know, kickstart their life into happening, as opposed to really embracing their time on their own and using it to develop themselves and create and live, you know, a very fulfilling and enriching life, whether someone's in it or not, you know, instead of making the relationship or someone else, the whole cake, they can be the icing on the cake, but not your life sustenance.
All right, we're going to take just a few minutes break, and then we're going to be back and talk some more with Lauren Mackler. Stay with us, and we'll be right back.
Listen to your favorite PRN show in your car or when you're out for a jog. You can download any show on the archives at any time. Visit the archives at progressiveradionetwork.com/archives. We can also be found in the iTunes store under Progressive Radio Network. All our archives are free, so go ahead and check them out. Thanks for listening to the Progressive Radio Network. Stay tuned to stay informed.
I've been on radio for 37 years, every day, and I'm pleased that the Progressive Radio Network exists, because this is the one form that brings together some of the most important, probing, creative, and dynamic minds on the planet. Join us each and every day, 24/7, on the Progressive Radio Network, your home for independent thinking.
This is Deborah Wolf, best-selling author and award-winning radio host of Animal Magnet Pet Radio. You can listen live to me every Tuesday at 1 p.m. Eastern for the best pet radio in America, Canada, and beyond. Hard-hitting pet issues, animal news, training tips, tricks, games, and quirky pet trivia, plus the A-list pet guests each week. Or listen anytime to past shows at ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. Listen to this show so you can be good to your animals. Cotel with Sierra Club Radio. Tune in Fridays at 11 a.m. Eastern on the ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com to hear interviews with green authors, activists, politicians, celebrities, and more.
Let your imagination fly. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Take a trip with me through the literary landscape of Writer's Voice. Join the tour and the conversation as we talk with writers of all genres about matters that move us and make us think. Right here on the Progressive Radio Network, every Saturday at noon.
You're listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Hey everyone, we're back and we're talking to Lauren Mackler, and she is amazing. She's giving us some really important life tips. She's been the guest lecturer at Canyon Ranch and Harvard University, and we are really happy to have Lauren with us. Hi, Lauren.
Well, I'm happy to be here. I'm having a blast.
Hey, tell me this. Let's say that I've got this brand new baby in my arms.
I'm sorry?
And let's just say I have this brand new baby in my arms. And what is it that I should do or should not do so that this child grows up living the best life that they can? What are some of the things I can do as a mom or dad?
What a great, that's, I got to tell you something, Molly, that's probably one of the best questions anybody has ever asked, ever.
Thank you.
Brilliant question. Oh, I'm so excited. Okay, so the first thing is, starting at a very basic level, the best thing you can do is carry your baby as much as you can that's possible on your body. It's called continuum parenting, and it doesn't have to be you, because certainly there's plenty of parents that are working. So, but, and again, I'm talking about an ideal world. So you're asking me, ideally, to have the best chance of that child having their innate wholeness remain intact and further developed. This is what I would suggest. You can have the baby in a sling in the front, backpack, but the child, the infant, the best place is on a parent or caregiver's body. You know, and you just go about your day, and the child is in the, you know, in against you, because it gives them a very strong sense of safety, security, connectedness, bonding, all of that. I also suggest sleeping with your baby, and I know that there's a lot of mixed feelings about it. That people are afraid they're going to roll over on their baby. You're not going to roll over on your baby. People don't roll over on their babies. You know, the parental instinct is too strong. And what you can do is you can put a futon on the floor as the child gets a little bit, you know, starts wiggling around so it doesn't fall off the bed. But again, it gives that child that's what the infant needs. It needs that closeness. It needs it as much as possible. And, you know, you also, I don't know if there's actually been any studies on this, but, you know, the SIDS syndrome, you know, the sudden infant death syndrome. You know, if you're lying next to your child and you kind of turn over or move, let's say that child does stop breathing. That could be the thing that kind of kickstarts the breathing happening again. You know, you're right there, you know, with the child. And if you're nursing, you know, you just have to roll over and nurse in the night. You don't have to get up and, you know, do the whole thing. So that's kind of the basic stuff at the infant stage and being there. You know, people are so afraid that, you know, if they attend to their child's needs when it cries, it's going to be spoiled. No. You're not going to spoil that child. That's what the child needs. The child needs to learn, when I have a need, it will be met. There is somebody there for me. And children that are left alone to cry and cry and cry it out and all of that, their experience is, there's no one there for me. I mean, that's what the experience is. So those things are really very, very important. But mostly it's just the closeness and the connectedness and the being there and mirroring back to the child, you know, as the child is, you know, looking in your eyes, eye contact and smiling and just being, you know, involved and present and there. Those things are very, very important. As the child gets a little older,
I got to tell you, Lauren, first of all, before you go any farther, I so agree with everything that you just said as a therapist. I think some books came out, and I know that they were directed to some of the Christian religions, and they were all about being focused on the parent rather than the child.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't think that the authors had ever seen a child or held a child and would come out with the kind of things that they said. So I love what you just said.
Yeah, and, you know, that might push some people's buttons. It's not my intention to do that, you know, but it's just this is what I believe and what I've experienced. I've raised two children, and I have used this approach with my children. And I think, you know, children that suck their thumbs, for example, that's a form of self-soothing. It's a form of self-soothing, and I don't want to make anybody feel bad whose child sucks their thumb, okay? But I want to just let you know that it's information, it's an indicator that you know they're maybe, you know, spending too much time alone, where, you know, as opposed to if you've got the baby on your body and they want to nurse, you know, you can just nurse, and they're getting the soothing and the nurturance there versus, you know, sucking on the thumb is, you know, the sucking impulse is what babies do. And
you can also see, Lauren, that when an infant is stressed, they will put their fist up to their mouth.
That's right.
And that's one of the, you know, quick signs that you can see that, you know, when somebody comes up and wants to hold your baby and the baby's fist goes right to their mouth, you should probably take your baby back.
Right,
hey, we've
exactly.
got an email. It says, how do you deal with a child that can't be separated from the parent? If my sister-in-law leaves the room, the child will not stop crying. The baby is just over a year old. Any advice on that?
Well, I think it's also important that the child is able to receive nurturance and closeness and is taught that other people can be a source of nurturance and closeness and connection. And so if you are only carrying your child and not allowing other people to hold and you know, be loving and connecting with your baby, then that's, you know, they will have that, you know, that separation anxiety because you're their one anchor. So I would encourage people to, you know, obviously you want to be discerning who you're going to allow, you know, whose arms you're going to put your baby in. You know, it's got to be people with good energy and that, you know, obviously the right kind of person. But I think that that's an important thing, along with having that continuum parenting, but allowing other people, you know, to hold and carry your child so the child isn't afraid of other people and isn't, you know, doesn't have that symbiotic bonding where it becomes sort of anxious if it's, you know, separated from mom. But that's also a very normal stage, by the way, you know, of development where they, you know, there is a strong connection and they don't like it if, you know, the parent is going away. But it's teaching them that, you know, that there are other sources of love and support and caring and that, you know, mommy's going to be right back, you know, but the child doesn't know that.
Right. Every grandma and dad out there that's had to, you know, deal with a crying baby for hours while somebody gets their nails done, right?
Right, right. And as a child gets older, you know, the infant, you know, I don't believe in the letting an infant cry it out. As a child gets older, though, they do need to learn containment and you know, not getting, you know, their needs met instantly. I mean, that is a process of development that has to happen, but you do it age appropriately. You know, because it, a one-year-old can't, you know, has a much harder time to be patient and wait than a 3 or 4-year-old. So that's, again, part of the parenting, the teaching. It's being a proactive teacher and saying, okay, you know, and reading up on the developmental stages, educating yourself, okay, what does the child need emotionally, you know, mentally and physically at the different stages so that you're consciously knowing, you know, because they don't come with handbooks, which is really unfortunate, isn't it?
One of the things that I tell people that are complaining about the way they were parented, you know, I say, well, how old were your parents when you were born? And they'll say, 22.
Right.
And I ask them, do you know anybody that's 22? And how expertise, how much expertise do you think they have right now in parenting? And it gives them a perspective to realize that we're all amateurs at this, and
that's
you have
right.
to find your way. But there is information out there, like your book, that can help people understand what they can do right and what they do wrong.
Yeah, and you know, and if you're not doing it, quote, the right way or the most, you know, the best way, the optimal way, it's important not to beat up on yourself. I mean, because, you know, parenting is really hard, and it's much easier to be a really great parent after they're raised. You know, it's like when you look back and you see what you've learned, and you learn through trial and error. But I think the conscious parenting is very important, and there are a lot of great resources, you know, out there. I mean, my kids are grown up now, but I remember, you know, I had these just fabulous books, and I just read voraciously during my first pregnancy and educated myself, so I knew. You know, I was empowered also when I had both my children in birthing suites in a hospital. So I was very empowered, you know, for example, not to let them take away my baby right after it was born, because that bonding time, those first couple of hours are so important for the bonding. If I hadn't read that and I didn't know that, you know, hospital procedures, they whisk the baby away and they weigh it and they make sure it's okay and they put it in the nursery for observation for a while. And I wouldn't let them do that. You know, and so
good for you.
Well, you know, and this was 27 years ago when my first one was born, where, you know,
right.
and things like, you know, they want to hook you up to the fetal monitor, you know, and you can't move around. You can't, you know, when you're in labor, you need to be able to move to keep things going. And, you know, and the more, you know, the less you're moving and can move around, the greater the chance for a C-section. You know, and that's just based on statistics. So those kinds of things, but I took it upon myself to learn about that stuff and learn. And it can be a little overwhelming because books will tell you different things. You know, one book says it's good to do time out, put them in a room. Another one says no. You know, so you have to kind of, you know, learn as you go along and try different things, and different things will work with different people and with different children for sure, you know. But in the work that I do, seeing the effects that stay with people throughout their whole lives from, you know, these things. And I just did a workshop this weekend at Kripalu, and I had a participant in the workshop, and this person's parents abandoned this person when the person was an infant, 6 months old. And the person was sharing about the effects that this has had on this person's life. And I'm not even going to identify the gender of the person, but, you know, that type of thing, when you think, well, at 6 months old, you don't even remember, but there's an emotional memory and there's experiences associated with that experience, like crying and no one's there for you, you know, and that becomes your experience.
So one of the things that you talk about is getting yourself ready for the relationship and being the partner that you seek. What do you mean by that?
Well, most people, if you take the average couple and you were able to take each, you know, the two parties and separate them and interview them in separate rooms, they're going to, and you say, you know, tell me about your relationship. More often than not, they're going to start complaining about their partner. They're going to start complaining about, you know, all the things that person is or isn't, and it's focused on, you know, what they want. A lot of adults or little kids you know, there are adults walking around with adult bodies, but they're little kids inside. And there's a void and there's a longing, and they're trying to get their partner to meet the needs that weren't met when they were little kids, like to be surrogate mom and dads. And they want that completeness, the sense of completeness, you know, by being in this relationship. And when I say become the partner you seek, it's instead of looking outside of yourself for the qualities of your ideal partner, you know, we are attracted to people that embody the qualities that we lack. We are attracted to people that can provide a certain quality of life that we can't afford, or can do things that are hard for us to do. And it's, we do that unconsciously in the unconscious quest for wholeness. We're trying to get back to that whole state with which we're born, and we do it unconsciously by trying to pull somebody in that is going to complete us. But that's a recipe for disaster for a couple of reasons. One is, if you're dependent on somebody else to make for your sense of well-being, your sense of wholeness, sense of completeness, sense of security, if and when that person goes away, let's say they die, let's say you get divorced, there goes whatever it is that they're providing for you. As opposed to saying, okay, what are the qualities, the life circumstances, the experiences that I'm looking for in an ideal partner? And how do I develop those qualities within myself and manifest those life circumstances on my own? So if and when someone shows up, wonderful. Great. Icing on the cake. Maybe they don't show up, or maybe they show up and it doesn't last. So that's going back to the action piece. I have an exercise in Soulmate where I have the reader identify all the attributes of their ideal partner and then go down the list and check off those that are true about them today and those that they can't check off, or what I call their gap areas. And instead of looking for someone else to meet those needs, create an action plan for how are you going to develop those qualities in yourself? How are you going to bring those new life circumstances to fruition on your own? So, and imagine two people in a relationship that are taking responsibility for being the ideal partner they seek. That's going to be a magnificent relationship. It's going to be two responsible adults that are expressing and meeting needs based on, you know, appropriate adult needs and wishes versus the longing, bottomless pit child that's trying to, you know, compensate for what was missing from childhood.
So you really end up giving to your partner instead of looking at them as the source of something you need to take.
Yeah. Yeah. You're taking, you know, you're much less needy, much less demanding, because you're coming to relationship from a place of wholeness, not from a place of lack. You're coming to relationship from conscious choice versus, you know, desperate need. Very different energy in the relationship.
So, Lauren Mackler, what about the person that is so afraid to be alone, they can't even go to a restaurant and order a meal because someone's going to see them and they're going to feel ashamed because they're not there with, you know, Mr. or Miss Wonderful?
Well, you know, that's actually another assignment that I have given to people, because they have assignments to do during the week in between their coaching sessions. And I have assigned that to many people. Mostly women have that issue. And I ask them to, they're going to take themselves to dinner, and they go to a place that has a nice bar. I do not recommend sitting at a table by yourself, because you can't connect to people. You can't talk to people. And unless you feel really comfortable and you want to sit there with your computer or your book and you don't want to be bothered and you're perfectly comfortable, that's fine. But in terms of this as an exercise and something to overcome a fear, you sit at the bar, and I usually assign to them that they need to, I ask them to initiate conversation with no less than one new person, not including the bartender. And there's things you can do, like you can bring an interesting book with an interesting title, you know, that is a way to kind of spark conversation. Someone say, oh, what are you reading? Making small talk. You see what somebody's ordering, say, oh, that looks good. What is that? And you just have a conversation. And you may be afraid, and it's simply because it's not part of your comfort zone. So you do this, and you have a nice experience, and, you treat yourself to a nice dinner. and then you do it again. So over time, it becomes part of your comfort zone. But you also have to look at what's the limiting belief that I carry that produces this sense of shame or fear, you know, and then do a reality check and say, is this something I truly believe, or is this something that I was taught that's not true?
Okay, give me an example of that, because that's pretty psychological. So,
well, a core limiting belief could be something like, I'm unworthy and unlovable. And so if you carry a core limiting belief of, and it's not something you're consciously thinking, I want people to understand, this is a internalized conclusion or truth that is embedded in the subconscious that colors how you see yourself in the world. But if you carry that, if you have that going on, then the idea of going and sitting at a bar by yourself and eating dinner by yourself is going to invoke this feeling of, you know, based on this feeling of unworthiness, the fear that people are going to see you as a loser, they're going to see you as pitiful, they're going to judge you, they're going to see you as worthless, that you have to be there by yourself and nobody wants to be with you, because it's being driven by this internalized truth that you've adopted a long time ago that you're unworthy.
Even though millions of people eat alone in restaurants and in bars all the time, just because you walk in there, all of this stuff is going to happen in your head, and you're going to feel miserable and you're not going to be able to eat.
Right. If you associate kind of being seen by yourself, kind of stripped away with no, you know, wing men or women, I guess they call them, you know, it's going to associate, it's going to trigger the emotional memory of, you know, discomfort, of shame, of whatever it is that you carry in your inner, you know, sort of conditioning of your conditioned self. It's going to get accentuated because you're doing something that's calling attention to yourself, that's out of your comfort zone. And, you know, it's very liberating to move through that stuff. It's very, very liberating. You feel so good about yourself. And for some people, you know, somebody, it might be nothing to go have dinner, you know, by themselves in a restaurant. But for somebody else, you know, it may be something else that is terrifying, like talking in front of a group or, going for the job that they want to have or whatever it is. But whatever it is that you're afraid of in, around these types of things, that's exactly, you know, you have to kind of look, do the analysis work to say, where is this coming from? Where is this rooted? And it's usually rooted in, you know, in the early life conditioning and the operating system that you adopted, and it's time to update it.
You know, and I think that there are many people that suffer with their inhibitions that don't need to, that there is a path out. And I love the kind of information that you're giving us here today. How do we get a hold of you if we want to have more?
Well, my website is my name, which is laurenmackler.com, and that's L-A-U-R-E-N, M like Mary, A-C-K-L-E-R, laurenmackler.com. And there's contact information there. There's an events page. I'll be at Omega doing my soulmate workshop May 13th through the 15th, and again at Kripalu in the fall. I'll be doing it in Canada and British Columbia in June. There's a whole events page at laurenmackler.com. And I also have a weekly radio show called Life Keys on Contact Talk Radio, which is on Mondays from noon to 1 p.m. Eastern at contacttalkradio.com. So there's a lot of, you know, they can get in touch and learn more about me at my website.
That's fantastic. And we have just a couple minutes left. And throughout the hour, you've said it a few times. You said, well, I don't want to sound like I'm the victim. And you said, people need to take responsibility. Talk to me about why that's so important in the art of aloneness to take responsibility. And what do you mean by that? And we have just a few minutes left.
Well, when I was talking about the victim, and that's where I was stuck after my divorce. I felt very victimized. I felt angry. I felt resentful. All of that. And a major turning point was when I was able to say, okay, how did I create, promote, and allow where I am in my life? How did I bring this to fruition? What was my part in this? Not from a place of blame, but trying to understand, seeking to understand. And what do I need to do differently to get out of it? And that's what I mean by taking responsibility. Because if you stay in the victim mode, the payoff is you don't have to do anything. You know, you don't have to do anything. It's not your fault. You're powerless. It just happened to you, so obviously you don't have to do anything because there's nothing to do because things just happened. But that mindset, while it allows you to stay, not have to do anything, and you know, what another payoff is, you know, you'll usually find somebody that's going to give you sympathy and support, the, you know, you staying in your victim role, like, poor you. But you stay stuck with what you have. You stay stuck with the life you have. You stay stuck with the internal environment that you have. And you don't have the possibility of creating and living a different life. And the victim role is, a lot of people have a lot of shame about it, and they get angry if somebody calls them a victim. And it's not, you know, to judge it, then it's not who they are. It's just a role they've adopted. It's just, you know, it's just a role. It's not them. But it's empowering. It's scary, and it's hard to take responsibility because, you know, there's no more excuses. But it's also liberating and tremendously empowering, and you've got the possibility and the option of creating a whole different life.
You know, you're talking about giving people excitement about their lives again, freeing them from all kinds of chains from the past. You know, this conditioned self versus what you call living deliberately. You know, how do you know when someone finally gets it? What do you see?
Well, they start behaving differently, and they start getting different results. Their lives change. I mean, this happens all the time. I went actually, I was teaching last fall at Kripalu, and this woman on one of the breaks came up to me in the eating room there, and she said, I wanted to find you. She said, I did your workshop. I forget when she had done it, you know, I think the year before or something, and she said, I just wanted you to know that I lived the vision statement that we created in that workshop. She said, I want you to know that I worked it, it worked. And she'd gone on a trip to some place in South America, which was a huge stretch for her. And it was a guided tour. And then she got there and found out that there was sort of nobody else really going on this particular arm of the trip. And she said normally she wouldn't have done it. She wouldn't have done the trip at all. And she said that she just realized, you know, went back to her vision, a statement of what it is she wanted to be experiencing and creating in her life, and she did it. And she was so excited. And I get emails from people all the time, or, you know, people will follow up and let me know. And it's gratifying because it's showing that the work works and that the approach is working, and it is allowing people to transform their lives. And that's how you know, is are they getting different results? Is their life different, and is it consistent? Is it sustaining? You know, is it moving and like a continuum that's moving on? As opposed to you talk to somebody a year later and they're still stuck in their stuff. They may just have a better, they may know what their stuff is, but they're still stuck in it.
All right, and you're going to be the guide here to help them get unstuck. And we want everyone to go out and get Soulmate, Master the Art of Aloneness, and Transform Your Life. Where is that available?
It's available at bookstores and online. And for anybody that may have not been here, you know, tuned in later in the show, it's spelled Soulemate, not the other kind of soulmate. People will
all right, Lauren, you have been a terrific guest. Thank you so much.
Oh, it's been my pleasure, and thanks for being such a wonderful host and asking such great questions. That makes it easy.
All right, Lauren Mackler, what a great guest. Thank you so much. All right, we want to thank all the people that make it possible. So the music is by Chris Jurgensen from the Big Bad Sun album. Thank you to Matt, my engineer, Jason, Joe the archivist, and Gary Null. Thank you for listening to the Dr. Molly Barrow Show. Please join us again every Tuesday morning at 10 Eastern, and you can visit my website at drmollybarrow.com for more information about me and my books. Be sure to join us again next week. I'm wishing you a beautiful day.